Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Hello, hi, howdy. And you and me. Takes a village to make a movie. The Daughter of God cast is on the cusp of our 19th episode. 19 weeks of telling the stories of the Daughter of God, and not so tangentially, me, your hardly humble host. Episode 019, The Calm Before. The strategy for bringing Daughter of God to the known universe is trust. I've talked about the evolving purpose of this podcast, from building an audience to discovering why iMovie. This is such a cool question, and such a powerful reason to get in front of a camera and microphone each week, not to mention writing these episodes, to explore why I am here, and perhaps why we're all here. I feel in some sense I'm podcasting for all of us. This experience of weekly remembering and reflection is one that I would highly recommend. I feel in some sense I am podcasting for all of us. This experience of weekly remembering and reflection is one that I would highly recommend. But pragmatically speaking, if everyone had their own podcast, who would have time to listen? I get to yammer on. I'm vanity publishing. This is both an amazing opportunity and a gift. All this technology and history has conspired to help me out myself on a weekly basis, to be worth listening to, which means pushing the envelope of my experience, mentally and emotionally. That's the part I recommend specifically, to practice being fully alive. Seems pretty clear that we get to choose whether we feel more or less alive. Happiness is just a feeling in the body. Yet some folks define arbitrary external conditions that must be met before they'll allow themselves to experience happiness. They seek to meet those conditions via TV, Facebook, pets, friendships, books, whether or not they get into the forest or even the yard, food, and the conditions have to be just so, or else. By the summer of 2007, I and my cohorts in Brooklyn were pretty adept with contriving optimal conditions. We had several swinging parties in the United Gardens. Our jam group, Way, was getting together regularly. We even had an impromptu naked jam out on the patio on a warm evening in September. We made a pilgrimage to gorgeous Fire Island for salty beach time. I got back to Michigan twice for freshwater swimming to throw a party with my extended friend family and a reunion of my bio family. My eyebrows had mostly grown back at this point, and I was starting to turn heads of the females of my species at last. I even found a steady lover in the fall, Daughter of God. So, the pursuit of happiness via manipulation of external reality was going gangbusters. Meanwhile, back at the Daughter of God, I scheduled ADR with Steve for August and September, added the new post-apocalyptic shots into the rough cut, and screened the project for select friends and family. My brother Mike and his wife Sarah had watched Dog at the Michigan family reunion in August. They had a similar reaction to Endon regarding the post-apocalyptic shots, and Mike was also turned off by Christina. From Michael Kelly, M. Kelly AZ at, subject Re comments on dog, date August 13th, 2007, to Dan Kelly, anything at. Okay, so I think the flow is pretty good. This is my synopsis of what I remember. Intro scenes. I had to stretch to get the post-apocalyptic setting because the images indicating society's fall were too subtle and looked to me to be images of just old stuff. The boat that the characters live on seems to be in good shape. The radio voiceovers have to do all the work to set the scene, and maybe this needs to be elevated. I like the scenes where Uncle Joe interacts with Christina. Those are fine, and the plot is set pretty well there. The mirror scenes and slow-mo or smear cuts, whatever, look pretty good and are effective. The scenes with Jerry and Christina have, I think, left me with the impression that you spent too much time, or each cut was too long, on the girl. She is such a poser actor compared to him that the disparity is distracting. She becomes uninteresting when you keep the camera on her for more than a few seconds. The aftermath scene spends way too much time on her cutesy manners, which are annoying unless taken in very small doses. This scene set should be very short cuts, in my opinion. The more you let the viewer see that interaction, the more trite and uninteresting it seems. Leave more to the viewer's imagination, not less. I think I don't get the end parts that I saw. It was intriguing with the two guys, but as soon as I saw the handwritten note in the info binder, I lost the sense of immersion. It looked out of place. Looks really, really professional all in all. If I remember more, I'll jot it down. Mike. My brother's critique of Carmen's acting is really a critique of my editorial. I liked Carmen's performance. I had directed Carmen to give precisely what my brother was critiquing. Later on, an editor colleague, Faisal, was even stronger with his feedback. He hated Christina and advised that I cut her out of the story. Tough to do when she's the main character. Clearly, this intense critique of Christina pointed to an opportunity. Neither my brother nor Faisal could see where I was trying to go with Christina. I knew my choices with casting Carmen and directing her were spot on, even brilliant, inspired. I just had to figure out why they were brilliant. Another journey. In August, Steve Ziliaks and I met in Sudbury for ADR, and I got to meet Carly, his sweet girlfriend, before we drove her to the airport. Steve's awesome parents, George and Meg, hosted us. They set up a big tent for me in the backyard. Steve and I jury-rigged the ADR suite in the basement's decrepit bathroom. I borrowed a ton of blankets for the walls and set up dual screens, one for Steve in the shower/booth and one for me outside. After a trip to the local electronics shop for a few extra cables, we went to work. Steve re-recorded all his dialogue, figuring that since we went to all this trouble, why not? The Ziliaks house was on a lake, and Steve and I got some great swims in, too. Swimming is the best! I left Sudbury and crossed the border at Sault Ste. Marie back into Michigan for a third Beulah visit. While I was there, I checked in with Willie, Marika, and their three kids, who were, like, growing up. Will and Marika, I mean. Back in Brooklyn, our neighbor and my collaborator, Philippa Kay, had bought an apartment in Greenpoint and was preparing to move from Prospect Heights. I flagged Laura Peterson and her husband, John Pope, and urged them to take over her apartment. I now had Laura and John living right next door. We had been talking about expanding our documentation and doing a dance for film, perhaps with her next big project, Electrolux, featuring the music of Led Zeppelin. Philippa and I had spent a great summer developing her project Humorphous, featuring dancers replicating the energy of animals. A fusion of science and art, my involvement was to create a compelling showcase and promotional video for the project. This was intended as a touring show for zoos and aquariums. We documented the project at the Prospect Park Zoo with the avid encouragement of the zoo's curator of education, Karen Tingley. Guests. Relations with my parents had been improving, to the point where I let them visit me in October. Pretty funny to see my parents in bunk beds. I was having a lot of fun with visitors and those bunk beds. My niece Maura and her boyfriend had visited earlier in the year. I think the Allegro family invaded with their five kids. I had multiple visits from Bob and Cynthia, and Bill Joslin came from the Wonderland days. Conditions reprise. Some hubris is built into successfully controlling external conditions. There's a confirmation bias of conditions supporting happiness, rather than the other way around, and we tend to focus on making situations ever more optimal. Back then, make was a pretty powerful word for me. Now I recognize that we don't so much make as we decide. Like whether we decide to live or die, bodies supposedly wear out, run down, fall apart. Telomeres and all that. How much of aging is a decision? 1%? 100%? Who wants to be less vibrant, less robust? Who would choose mental and physical decline and death? So many people assume that there is no choice and thrive or not by default. We show up on Earth full of life, but vulnerable and in need of constant protection. After some growing up, we reach a point where we're autonomous and feel our power and vitality surging. Received wisdom states that this is supposed to level off and start declining. We're gonna start feeling and looking less vibrant and fresh, feeling a little creaky, and next thing you know, you're in a nursing home and then a coffin. Or maybe shivering under a bridge and then stiff in the county morgue. According to my observations of the dominant culture, having a youthful body and attitude is permissible for about 35 years. Then, if you want to continue being accepted into the pack, you've got to start dying. Your mind must close, your body must become more fragile and slack. Fear and worry become more acceptable and encouraged. You assign the future to your kids, if you've got them. Now, I'm 53, and maybe you're 20. You're listening and like, this is scary shit. I'm glad I don't have to think about this for another 20 years. I've got 20 years of kick-ass life ahead, and I'm going to rock the universe. Well, right on. What I'm trying to say here is that 20 years is nothing. Maybe you've got 100, 500 years, but because you're already buying into the decline and death scenario, you're freaked out about looking ahead. You're cheating yourself. If you're 60 or 70, maybe you're like, dude, just wait until you've got to have an artificial hip or taking chemo for cancer, blah, blah, blah. There's lots of reasons to turn this podcast off and just keep doing what everybody else is doing. Go ahead and die. I'm not stopping you. What if senescence was just a decision to be less alive? The obverse would be deciding to be more alive every day. How does one decide to be more alive? I have borrowed and developed many strategies. I am more than willing to share, but what works for me may not work for you. For me, the central tenet is just deciding, choosing to be more alive in every way I can think of. For instance, cultivate curiosity, especially about the human experience in all its wonderful variety. Be gentle with yourself. Flip that critical voice into an over-the-top personal cheerleader who's certain you are always the cat's pajamas. Stop thought entirely for 20 to 30 minutes and just be. Eat things you've grown yourself. Now, you probably thought I was going to play the yoga, tai chi, or vegan card, right? I mean, that stuff is fine, but just feeling wonderful is a spiritual practice. There's no telling what the human body is capable of. Sure, there's always a meteor ready to intersect Earth's orbit, or a streetcar waiting to run you over. But don't go jumping in front of the streetcar until you're good and ready. Then do it with a smile. So, surprise, turns out podcasting is another decision to enliven. I think because I'm talking about choosing, about how I've come to choose more life, and fundamentally, how I realized there was a choice to begin with. In 2007, I had external conditions humming along while trying to extricate my self-identity from the mainstream narrative. Back then, I was defining myself by chafing against what I didn't want, standing in contrast to alien paradigms. Some almonds are easier to skin than others would launch under a new production company, Terrorist Training Films. I registered $204 worth of domain names on June 1st. Terroristtraining.net, .org, .us, .biz, .tv, .info, and .mobi, but didn't deploy a website. Not quite yet. I kept these domain names at the ready, powerful culture jamming resources, until Almonds was polished and ready for festivals. Terrorist Training Films was a lifting of the kilt to the military-industrial complex and the Bush-Cheney Forever Wars. I was a lone commando behind the lines of American empire and ready to throw sabots into the gears of consumption first chance I got. My peace action in 2003 was documented in secret FBI files, available to Canadian border guards, but not to me. I interpreted this as an attack, an attempt to impede my movement, to intimidate and frighten. My only course of action was to assume the worst, that the minions of the FedGov had, or were about to label me, a terrorist. By preemptively embracing their language, I'd be better positioned to turn it upside down and sideways. Here's an excerpt from the Amman synopsis on the Film Festival Consolidator Without a Box, presenting my first pass at the premise for Terrorist Training Films. I talked about my 2003 arrest and subsequent revelation at the Canadian border, seeing my FBI record. And then, in the spring of 2007, a rough cut for Daughter of God, Dog, was complete. A camping trip to an island wilderness would provide the deserted shoreline needed to composite a wrecked cruise ship scene. Production on the island would not be limited to Dog, though. It was time to process the implications of Kelly's FBI file. If the USA's government was starting to target protesters, he ought to have a plan. The distorted FBI record might presage more dire threats. These days, folks who vigorously advocate social justice, environmental sustainability, and spiritual activation are likely as not to be labeled terrorists. Kelly embraces this doublespeak. Like most Americans, Kelly can't help but consume. It's dangerous to deny addiction. Awareness is the first step to recovery. If rapacious consumption threatens our earth, then consumers are the ultimate terrorists. To train the terrorists is to save the world. In hindsight, I can see how I was boxing myself in. Terrorist Training Films might have been a zany cognitive jujitsu move, but against myself mostly. I was talking in a broken tongue, playing a rigged game, snarled in someone else's paradigms. My imperfect understanding of the game and who they were was based on radical references like The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn and War is a Racket by Colonel Smedley Butler, not to mention trippy reality-inspired fiction like Illuminatus Trilogy. I was preparing to overthrow occluded oppressors with art, not realizing that the oppression was always and only within. I had climbed into a matrix of my own making and was rallying against self-imposed limits and obstacles. Not to say that oppressors are always a fiction, just that their status as fact or fiction relies on the quality of attention we assign them. Each of the Dog characters could be said to be an analog for me. I was a little bit of Christina, going with the flow, letting the universe be her designated driver. She had survived many traumas this way, releasing control, trusting that everything would work out. I was also Uncle Joe, the seemingly all-knowing, snarky angel, showing up to drop some revelation on the hoi polloi. Finally, I was Jerry, crushed and crisped, but not nearly neutralized. Perhaps even with a little phoenix action up his sleeve. These characters were a way of working out my own story, a way to process the horror show supporting American exceptionalism, American empire, American ignorance. Still the activist from way back in episode 002. Nowadays, having fun is how I present, because going on and on about what sucks is the very trap itself. What's needed is to free ourselves from patterns of self-loathing and start experiencing the world we wish to live in. This is just a story, anyhow, about what was happening in 2007, where my head was. The title of this episode, Calm Before, is fairly transparent. Calm before what? In the year of the pig 2007, I had several great dance collaborations under my belt. I had recalibrated my expectations of completion for Daughter of God and was genuinely enjoying the evolution of the movie. I was getting laid more often. And our little artist gang was gathering together regularly and having a blast. We were all pretty happy. The year of the rat would be a different story. The beginning of the end. 2007 was the last golden year of the United Gardens for me. A great run while it lasted. You've just expanded your consciousness with another 19 minutes of the Daughter of God cast, episode 019. And whether you're 19 or 90, I and all my imaginary friends are so glad that you could be here with us. I was practicing Tai Chi on a sunshiny day around the United Gardens patio when Trevor showed up from somewhere way tipsy. He shyly challenged me to battle him, and when I agreed, he got this zany, shit-eating grin and assumed a sort of crouchy pro wrestling sumo grapple posture. I just started laughing and laughing. I was so overcome that I was utterly unable to defend myself, and he easily took me out. I bow to the drunken master, whose crazy, hilarious energy checkmated all my training. I'll always remember Trevor, sparkling with alcohol-fueled hilarity, totally in his power.